Okay, so staying on this mobile kick for a while. First question, let's just go right down, starting with Rich. So from your different, very different perspectives, what have you seen as the single greatest success in mobile, what we call mobile cloud, the whole mobile cloud space? Biggest home run?
So there are several companies that provide this, but I think the best thing out there is that I can access the same content on any device I've got, and I almost don't even have to manage it. I can just open something, edit it, no matter what device or which location I'm in, and then I can close it, and I can go somewhere else. I can drop my phone in the lake, and I've still got my stuff. That, to me, is takes all the worry that we used to worry about out of computing.
Okay, the remote cable. Dan?
I'll go one step more specific than that, I think. I think it's email. Email is an example of, you know, we're kind of on the tail end now of the technology maturity. The next generation of users doesn't even use it. Think about that for a second. But people who can afford $700 smartphones every 18 months, those people use email. They count on it still. That's how they run their business. That's how, frankly, how they communicate with their families, with their friends, for the most part, still. And it's ubiquitous on mobile devices. It works really well. It works essentially equivalently, regardless of what device you buy. Commodity prices, commodity performance. It's a home run. But now we need the next one.
Isn't it just texting? Isn't it?
I don't think the next generation, they've even leapfrogged texting, right? They're on to like Snapchat and stuff that I don't even understand. But anyway, texting I don't think is the next thing. I think texting is maybe more arguably another of the current things. I think the next thing is going to be another, it'll be the next Facebook, that kind of thing.
Big one. Ranga.
I think the storage area for me has been probably one of the biggest, I would say, which is just the notion that be somewhere remote, right? You don't have to have your laptop anymore. You have access to it. I can't remember I'm totally even blanking on it, but there was a company just even probably 3 or 4 years ago, it was a notion that you could go and log in and you can access your files on your home computer. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of the name right now. I'm totally blanking my name, but you know, that was a big thing when that came out. But now you've got Box, you've got Dropbox, you've got, you know, all these different cloud providers out there from a storage perspective that all of us as consumers could go and easily access just huge amounts of data, which I think is a big change, and it just gets easier and easier, and the prices have really come down. I mean, with Apple's last announcement, I mean, how much did, you know, even Apple's price their iCloud, which then Dropbox and everyone else met, you know, you can get a terabyte of storage in the cloud for, you know, practically nothing.
So you think services like Google Drive and Dropbox kill the backup storage applications or offerings?
I don't necessarily think they've killed it. I definitely think there's still a lot of room and opportunity for that, but it definitely pushes the need to make it easier and better. I mean, how many people out there, I can tell you how many of my colleagues out there where their laptop dies and it's like, yeah, I didn't do a backup and we didn't have any solution, and so they're still stuck with that, right? It's whatever they have in their email or whatever.
But they could
have
solved that if
they could have, right?
If they used Dropbox the right way or Google.
But they're not necessarily. So I still think there's an opportunity for that. I mean, Dropbox and Box are getting better with it, with kind of automatic synchronization. But
right.
I think there's a lot of opportunity there still.
iCloud is an example of exactly how those solutions, those backup and restore solutions, should have worked from their genesis, you know, whatever, 20 years ago. The fact is, people are taking ridiculous pictures of themselves, right? And they automatically get backed up into the cloud. That's exactly what you want to happen. Now,
unless
the problem is then there's still some security homework that you got to do, right, on protecting that account. But that's an invariant across whatever kind of service you're talking about.
Sure.
The point is backup and restore should be seamless. And Apple actually did that, and that's fantastic.
There's a few of those pictures that may not necessarily be, you don't want this.
Celebrities with clothes on.
Right. We'll wait for the cocktails for that discussion. Yeah.
So let's stay with Dan on this one. What has been the most epic fail so far in mobile cloud? What has been the biggest disappointment so far? What hasn't really worked the way we might have liked to see it? Or to be more politically correct, where's the opportunity for greatest improvement in mobile cloud?
Epic fail, I think, that I see right now, I do have a background in enterprise security, so this is very much colored by that. But when the predominant device here domestically is the iPhone, and nobody buys an iPhone based on security capabilities, nobody buys an iPhone based on enterprise capabilities, let's just say that makes it tough for the security consultants of the world. That keeps us employed, but it makes it tough. When the predominant device overseas is a commodity Android, where they've taken two versions of an open source software lagging back and they slap it on an old piece, cheap piece of hardware, I totally get the economics. But again, it's not an enterprise capable device. It's very difficult to secure data being downloaded to those devices. So the BYOD thing is a huge opportunity, but it's essentially devices that are not ready to do what they're being called upon to do. And I don't know if you call that a fail, but it looks like there's a big gap to me.
Okay. Ranga, where have you seen the greatest opportunity for improvement?
Well, I think to Dan's point, right? I think the fact of the matter is what caused the problem in our industry in terms of the enterprise application space is it hasn't helped our case in terms of providing access to that data, right? I mean, if the devices aren't secure, or IT doesn't feel like they're secure enough, then they don't want to provide access to that information. Right. So forget even if it's possible, it's the security aspect of it that lags, and all the breaches that we've had more recently, while not directly related to that, aren't helping the situation any and reassuring. It's like, well, see, I told you so. If we had put our data out there, it wouldn't have just been your own personal financial data, it'd be all of our corporate financial data. So to me, that I think is, I kind of would echo what you said, which is it's been a pretty big disappointment.
Yeah, yeah. Anything, any different perspective, Rich?
I think I'm gonna add the government perspective on this,
sure.
State government. I think that government has missed an opportunity in that, in the way that it deploys software or to their constituents, for example, there is Texas.gov, and it's a website that you can go and renew your driver's license and do things like that. Engage with your government. There's FirstGov.gov, other things that provide services. If they open it up to be more like an application development environment, like you can, if you want to go write an Apple app, you can go do that and put it out there and see if people like it. If the government opened up for creative people to put together applications and then based on the use of them got compensated for them, I think that would free up a lot of good ideas.
Interesting. So you guys start talking about security as an issue in the mobile space. Let's zero in on that a little bit more. Start with Ranga this time. What kind of, is there a silver bullet here, or there be like dual authentication, or is there something special in when you're addressing mobile security versus kind of more static enterprise closed security that would help?
I don't know if there's a silver bullet. I think there are. I think part of this it's a challenge, right, in the sense of. The more strict you get with things like passwords and two-factor authentication, all these other things that people find a way to make it easier for themselves, which end up being a post-it note on their on their iPad or their laptop to remind themselves of how to get in. So I don't know if there's a silver bullet. I do think there's definitely more that the device manufacturers could do in terms of providing ways that it doesn't just have to be. A password that has to have 13 special characters and, your mother's maiden name and all these other things, which end up being, I think, the stricter they make those password requirements, the worse it ends up getting because people end up finding other ways to get that information and not making it available to them.
So what else could they do?
I think if there were ways that they you know, whether it's the, I would love to see more better ways on the biometric side, or
you know,
like the fingerprinting, for example. And Touch ID is starting to get there, but you know, I know that's, that can be controversial in terms of how well it actually works. But I definitely think that's, you know, starting to get there, and getting the notion that you have to have that, you know, in place, that you can't just make it an optional thing. I mean, how many people get their phone stolen and still unlocked? Mm-hmm. It's still, we probably found two phones last year in the park over the course of the year, and both were unlocked. And we just waited, and someone called us, and we were like, hey, we have your phone.
Bought some stuff on Amazon first, though, right?
We did. We did.
The revenue stream. Yeah.
Rich, what about you? What can we do in mobile security?
You know, that's a major issue. Security is for the state government agencies that we work with. I think they're just going to have to back when I was with Gartner, there was this concept that they talked about of pretty good security, which isn't a great way to market yourself as a security provider, to call it pretty good security. But the point being that there's some kind of balance there. You do enough where you say this should prevent, you know, most of your issues. And then from there, you've got to be able to move forward. You can't let security completely stop your progress.
Last word from Dan on this one.
I think that's a great point. I think that pretty good security is what's not being done. I think that if that was the baseline for every product that we bought, that you know, that the screen locks automatically. And you know what? If you don't want your screen to lock, then you got to turn that off. You can, but it's on by default, right? The little solid state disk, let's make that be encrypted by default. So if somebody picks up your laptop in the park and they want to buy stuff on Amazon, well, you know, it was locked by default. And if they pull the little drive out and they want to read it from another device, they can't, because it's encrypted to your SIM, right? It's the security basics. And actually, that's, quite frankly, as a security consultant, in some sense, our job becomes really easy because we go into an engagement and they aren't doing the basics. And it's like, okay, guys, let's go back to IT 101. Yes, it's a new shiny technology, and yes, you're intimidated by this thing that you're being told to do by the business people, but you know what? It's the basics over again. You know, protect the data, authenticate the user, look at your auditing, this kind of thing, and that would raise the bar in and of itself and in a meaningful way.
Good point. Let's go back to Rich. In the government space, maybe even over at a little more on the military side, because that's more interesting use case with intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, that kind of thing. Are there special considerations for using mobile and in those kind of operations?
I like that slide that was put up not long ago about that even in the intelligence space, they're going to need to be considering cloud.
Yep.
Back in 2010. The federal CIO at that point mentioned that cloud first. He put together the research and the paper to say, this is the way the federal government is going, we're gonna consider cloud first. And security was the issue there. I think that so much progress has been made along those lines that it's trickled down to state and local governments, is what I've seen, that they're responding to that to the degree that Texas has adopted a similar policy. In terms of military and the intelligence community, from what I've heard, the mobile space is an open market. They're willing to look at ideas that people are coming up with. It's not like they have a locked-in thing that they have to do. They're willing to look at new technologies.
Yeah.
Snowden did a huge amount of damage to the trust between the private and public sector. And I'm not saying that there shouldn't be blame or that there is blame or anything. I'm just saying the damage was done. And that's unfortunate because there's a big opportunity between you know, in terms of shared capabilities, you know, what does DoD do really well? What does DoD know? What has DoD invested for the past 60 years in terms of information security? Private sector can benefit from that. Likewise, what is private sector doing, you know, in the entrepreneurial space? You know, what new capabilities can private sector bring to the market much more efficiently, much quickly? And again, when those conversations aren't happening, the information exchange isn't happening, and everybody suffers as a result of that. And so I think that there's a big latent opportunity in rebuilding that information exchange between public and private sector. And I think cloud security, cloud adoption, let's say, is at the core of that. I think it would indeed accelerate once those conversations kind of get back to, okay, now we can trust each other again.
Could I follow up just with that? Because sure. You mentioned Snowden, and from my limited understanding of that situation, here was a person who had access to things versus someone who broke in. He made copies he should not have, but essentially the system, the security system, did not fail. Do you have any follow-up thoughts on that?
No, that's... So let me say two things. One is, when I say Snowden, I'm actually referring to, you know, the public perception of Snowden, which was the, you know, the government taking the cellular carrier data, which, I mean, actually had nothing to do with Snowden whatsoever, right? It was just different. It was just an unfortunate thing that was disclosed as a result of Snowden, right? I think that's what eroded the trust. To your point, the real lesson to learn from Snowden was, holy crap, a super sophisticated organization made some really basic mistakes when it comes to understanding who has access to what information and just letting it walk right out the door, right? And those are the lessons that we can learn from what happened with Snowden. And to your point, yes, that was his job. His job was to have access to all that information. So, you know, what does that tell us? What are the controls we need to have in place about classifying data, about auditing who has accessed it, auditing whether one person really does have access to a whole bunch of stuff that maybe that one person shouldn't have access to, all of that data, that kind of thing. So I think there's a useful lesson there in Snowden. And there's a bunch of unfortunate damage that was done to trust that really has nothing to do with that.
True. Ranga, last word on government and mobile.
You know, I think I would just echo what Dan said. I think it's part of what has caused, you know, challenges in the adoption side of things, is that, you know, there isn't, it's a lack of trust, and that trust affects everything. But I do think there's huge opportunity. I think, as you know, that as Rich brought up, right, you know, we've seen some applications as the government is moving towards cloud, right? They've seen not just cost savings, but, you know, productivity, huge productivity gains. And I think that, to me, is you know, they can get past the security aspect of it, which some of it, I think, is perception versus reality. There's a huge opportunity in terms of productivity that I think they can gain that, you know, other private sector have
sure.
has gained. Tremendously.
Tomorrow we're going to spend quite a bit of time on the healthcare and life sciences sector. We haven't talked about it too much today, but when you're thinking about mobile and healthcare, things like field trials and, you know, clinical trials and treatments, what other perspectives do you have on mobile cloud for healthcare? Start with, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I wasn't actually necessarily thinking from the field trial perspective, but on the healthcare side, the whole PHI conversation and HIPAA, I think, is a huge challenge, because it's now it's another level of you know, that very personal information about
right.
your healthcare background and providing that and making sure that's available. On the flip side, as a consumer, we need to make it easier to be able to provide that access and make it there. But how do you balance those two pieces? So I think there is. To me, the huge opportunity on the healthcare side of mobility is, how do we securely provide access to your PHI information and you know, making that more readily available.
I mean, when you go into most medical practitioners' offices, you still have to fill out a piece of paper with a pen. When you go to Starbucks and swipe your smartphone and actually exchange money. So.
Well, I was in the office last week. I have two kids, and I was scanning in my kids' vaccination cards and that's the record that I have of my kids' vaccinations. Is this like your little yellow card that's like 4 pages long that, you know, we have to scan in and you know, we email to our daycare or whatever. But you know, that's the state of our vaccine records, right?
Do you have any observations on?
Yeah, I'm in favor of having an electronic medical record for each individual, similar to the program that we have for credit in this country, like a credit rating, not that you would have a health rating, but that the information would be protected and distributed in a very coordinated, legislated way, where certain companies that you said, like a hospital, you could say, I grant my access to my information, and here's the trail for that. I clicked on a button, said I grant access to this doctor for the information. But at the same time, you have an ability as a consumer to view it and to make comments on it and rebuttals and provide proof and have things removed, et cetera, kind of like we have for the credit program.
Interesting. Dan?
As a consumer of the inevitability of electronic medical records, I am somewhat frightened because regulation, which is also, let me say, is not only inevitable, but I do believe in. But the problem with regulation and security and technology, as everyone knows, is that regulation is always going to lag. And what happens with regulation is it becomes a checkbox and says, yes, you can put all this scary data up on the internet. It just has to be encrypted. Right, or some super vague term like that, right? And at the end of the day, the way that compliance is going to be made with that regulation by somebody who has my medical history, you know, posted on the internet, is going to be consistent with the regulation, but probably meaningless from the perspective of leakage of that data. And again, that does somewhat frighten me, and I don't have a good fix for that, quite frankly, other than. It's incumbent upon not only the government, of course, but it's incumbent upon private sector to be transparent. I think it actually goes back to the cloud providers as well, to be transparent about, hey, when it comes to securing your data, you know, however it's classified, here are the protections that we apply to that data, and here's actually how those protections are implemented. Here's how we're making sure that this is not just checkbox compliance, but it's actually meaningful security. And people have to demand that. We have to say that's what we want. We want meaningful security, or we're not going to use this service. We want our health provider to demonstrate that they're using this implementation that uses meaningful security, or we're going to go somewhere else, right? I think that's the only way you're going to get better than just checkbox compliance.
True. I'm just curious about your perspectives on why healthcare got, you know, healthcare.gov. So we're getting the healthcare and the government sectors kind of clashing or getting closer and closer together in some ways. Why was that such a mess? What did they do wrong at the beginning?
Did we have that long?
Ranga, you go first.
You know, it's a classic Big Bang kind of approach to things, right? It was requirements not well defined up front. It was, you know, the requirements not well defined up front, deadlines moved too quickly or pushed too quickly, things getting in late, things pushed in late in the cycle. I mean, classic enterprise application failure in the sense of that, you know, it was didn't properly define the requirements up front. The deadlines were unrealistic, and then the, you know, there were constant changes throughout the process. So, of course, it's gonna fail because it's hard to get, you know, hard to design it properly if you don't know exactly what you're designing for, and then throughout that process, you know, there's constantly changing of the of what needs to get in there. It's no surprise that it failed.
Anybody else want to comment?
I think that ignoring.
Right. So I think that when you put political expedience in front of, you know, making a change like that, that is arguably critical infrastructure, you're asking for disaster.
That's irregardless of whether you agree with the need for that service in the first place, right? But the fact is, the government is responsible for delivering critical infrastructure, right? And you got to depoliticize that. And if you depoliticize that, I think there's a much higher likelihood of it getting done right. But on the other hand, I think that technology providers have to share blame here. Right? I mean, look at what's happened with the air traffic control system it's been redesigned for like, what, 10 years now or 15 years now or something like that, right? And it's just one of those things where it's like, okay, well, maybe you could argue it's just too hard of a problem at the end of the day. But, you know, we have solved hard problems before. We've put man on the moon and all that kind of stuff. So it can be done. And I would argue that that's a much less example of something being, you know, politicized, right? The private sector has just done a bad job of it. So there's shared blame, let me be clear, but I think when the political process gets in the way, then you know, you get what you get.
Right? They should have just outsourced it to Amazon as an e-commerce assignment.
Well, I think they outsourced it to HP or something, right? It's like HP should be able to do something like that. I mean, let's be honest, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, who knows what's going wrong, right?
I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, though. I mean, I don't necessarily know that the political issue was the challenge. Regardless of whether you agree, it's a good or bad thing. I don't know that it was the politicization of it that caused the issue. I think, I mean, and give me to HP. I mean, HP and SAP. I mean, HP and IBM are well responsible for their own share of IT failures. I think it is. You're right. It is the technology providers, but it was the technology providers with those providing the requirements, right? And to me, that was more of a challenge. I mean, there's lots of challenges, and there's lots of examples in the enterprise space or in the consumer space or whatever of high-profile failures. The difference is, since it was healthcare and it's for the whole country, it was a lot more public. It was a lot more public. But I don't think there was anything political about the reason. Right. I don't think if you took out the politics of it, that it would have been any better.
I think history is going to be much kinder as we get further from the deployment. Yeah. I think it'll be seen as a success because eventually they got it worked, right, and didn't have to just turn it off and walk away from it. That would have been a failure.
That's a good point.
Did you have a question, Neil?
I did. You brought up Snowden. So you mentioned several times that he eroded the trust of the public government's handling the data. So the question I have is, what do you mean by that? Right? So who should we trust with what data? And since you guys talked about healthcare and you're concerned about HIPAA-compliant data being in the cloud, what about non-HIPAA-compliant data? At least that's regulated, right? Are you concerned about geolocation data, your travel data, all that data that is collected by all the websites that we visit also being in the cloud and unregulated? So this concept of data trust is really interesting. I'd be interested in hearing your comments about it.
I think when... So again, I think I was unclear when I made my initial comment about Snowden. I think where the real erosion of trust happened was, quite frankly, I haven't reviewed all the documents that Snowden released. I quite frankly, I have better things to do with my time than to read all those documents, right? But my understanding is that it's a tiny subset of all of that data that refers to data exfiltration by the NSA and other entities of cellular connection data in the United States and other countries. And that, in particular, played an outsized role in undermining trust between public and private sector, specifically in my view of security professionals. And I think that's where damage has been done, because that information exchange between public and private sector and security is critical for securing critical infrastructure. So that's the specific Snowden damage that I was talking
about. People shouldn't be concerned about the misuse of data that's being collected? That's my point, right? Is that you'd said that regulation kind of comes behind the use of activities and such in healthcare or anywhere else. This is a clear case where regulation is pretty far behind the use of data. And I think that people should be concerned about the misuse of that data, either by the government or by commercial enterprises or other people.
I totally agree, yes. And again, I didn't mean to imply that I don't think people should be outraged, but outrage isn't solving any problems, right? The point is, okay, some people screwed up. Now we need to make the process better. We need to make the system better. We need to do a better job. And it's not just the government that plays a role in that. It's private sector too. If you have your data and you're using Gmail or Hotmail or whatever, and your provider of that email service isn't encrypting the links between two data centers, and that allows any entity to just, including the cable providers, right, to just siphon that data off and make some sort of business decisions or make some sort of, you know, illicit activity based on the fact that those links aren't encrypted, come on, man, that's just stupid.
So I agree with that 100%. And in that light, don't you think we owe a debt of gratitude to Snowden for at least drawing some attention to the fact that that data is not encrypted and brought, you know, to a place where anybody can kind of sniff it and collect it?
So here we are, whatever it has been, 2 years hence. And my point is, let's get past the outrage and let's get past the gratitude and let's fix the problems. And I think that that's what I'm seeing has not happened, quite frankly.
I agree.
It's just lost time. That's all.
Okay. Anybody else right now want to ask? I've got a couple more. We're just banging through these verticals. So let's go to the media and entertainment sector, which has all kinds of openings for content everywhere, you know, any device, anytime. Start watching an episode of Grey's Anatomy on your big screen, then flip it to your phablet, take it out of the house so you're still watching it when you get on the train. So what's been the greatest advancement or achievement to date in mobile cloud for the media space?
Maybe not Grey's Anatomy, but the Game of Thrones, on your mobile device.
It is a monumental achievement, though. You have to admit.
No, I said it wasn't the Grey's Anatomy part that I was. It was Game of Thrones that I was saying on your mobile device, on the media side. I do think it's just it's all the ability to the streaming content that you can access on literally any device, and how far that's gone. I mean, just three or four years ago. To get access to that content and get access to it, when you weren't connected was obviously a lot harder, and now it's just getting so much easier to do that.
Is that because of variable bit rates have gotten more clever about detecting what your connection rate is, or what has been the? I mean, it seems like it's more ubiquitous. What's been the driver?
I think partially it's competition, so there's more pressure. So for every single provider to make their content available and make it available streaming,
right.
I do think there's that. But what I was going to say was I think that where there's the point they've gotten to now is to get it to the point of, hey, you can stream the content, but if you want to take it with you on an offline format, that is still, I think there's still room to go in terms of that. So I think from an accomplishment perspective, it's now, pretty much wherever you're at, you can get access to the information. I do think the fact that they've been able to ratchet it down based on download speeds and things like that is a big change. I think that the next area will be definitely where you can provide more access to it, but in an offline format as well.
So down, not a cloud DVR to just give you access, but it'd be able to download some part of the...
Okay. Exactly.
I think by far the biggest contribution and biggest achievement is in taking something that somebody produces locally and being able to upload it. I think YouTube says it all, right? Mm-hmm. It's saying we're not watching what somebody else decided to put out there. We can put our own stuff out there. But it's also a little more than that. I think something that YouTube represents is the concept that the internet is now too big. We need to break it up into sub-internets. Because if you think about it, YouTube is really a sub-internet of video content. Instead of, if I want to go find something about the McDonald's Corporation, I can either go to Google and check on the text-based, or I can go to YouTube and look up McDonald's and see any commercials or things like that. So it's like a sub-compartmentalization. Facebook is the same thing. It's a sub-version of the internet where you can go and find specific kinds of information, still the same layer of all the different people you know and that kind of thing, or companies that you want to interact with. But the internet is kind of breaking up into these functional areas to facilitate searching based on what kind of information you want.
Can I ask a question back to Rich on that? Do you think that's a good thing or bad thing?
I think it's great, and I think people can take advantage of it by figuring out what the next subsection would be to come up with that and move forward.
You're dying to say something.
I think just to take a slight tangent on that, I think what I've heard that's interesting in the news lately, talking about video to mobile, is what the NFL is doing. And I think what the NFL is doing is interesting in as much as it's kind of this weird dual counterpoint where it's kind of taking the ad revenue model of traditional terrestrial broadcast and turning it up to 11 in like this last hurrah of like, here's where advertisers can reach, you know, I don't know what the figures are, but hundreds of millions of people, right? Guaranteed. Eyes glued to the TV as the game is being played, right? And that basically doesn't exist in any other form anymore, right? But you can also view the games on mobile, right? And it's a great experience. It's really cool. You get high quality video, you get the stats, you get the player stats and all this drill in capability. It's like the dashboard that every CEO wishes he or she had, except it's about football, right? So what does that mean? The fact that that is like there's this incredible video capability, but it essentially is, you know, irrelevant from a revenue perspective, the NFL, it's like an afterthought, right? I don't know. I can't get my mind around that yet.
All right. Interesting. So let's just, I have one last question for you. When we get away from the three verticals we're on at this show, are there some other areas of the economy where mobile cloud has been particularly disruptive or promising besides government or healthcare or media?
Absolutely, education. I think that's a huge potential revenue for a company that wants to invest in mobile and come out with some killer app that a series of school districts could adapt.
That was an interesting stat this morning about the rapid growth from I think Amazon talked about, I don't know if you were there for that, but they were talking about their growth sectors and that came at the bottom like, boom, you know, just 2,400 deployments or something like that. Amazing how fast that's picked up.
I mean, retail, right? I mean, retail has been the big recipient, I think, in that recipient, or depending on how your perspective, the disruptive nature of mobile, right? That you can buy anywhere, shop anywhere, regardless of what it is. I think that's been a huge disruptive force in the retail industry. It's, you know, Radio Shack's probably going to go out of business, right? Circus City's already gone. How many of these other stores are gone? Just because these companies haven't evolved, and even 5 years ago, look at how popular Best Buy was, and you know, showrooming has literally almost crushed their business.
Mm-hmm. Brick and mortar retail, definitely.
Yeah, brick and mortar retail.
I think just to take a horizontal stab at it, it's to me, it's where my business practice is, of course. But the knowledge worker, you brought that up in your talk. I just think that the way that the cloud and mobile has enabled the knowledge worker to do more than just, you gave a great example of watching videos on YouTube, right? But to me, what's interesting is not only can you watch videos on YouTube, but then you can actually synthesize and create content based on that, even on a mobile phone. And that's a huge achievement, right? And I think that that's actually creating a lot of value. Yeah.
Tremendous. You guys stick around for the networking break? We sign books?
I would love to.
So, congratulations. Anybody else have a question? I don't want to be unfair. We're going to take our break a little bit early for once, so we can go get some refreshments next door, and then we'll come back for the final program block of the day before cocktails at 4:30. Thanks.
Thank you.